At this moment, across our nation, hundreds of thousands of Americans have joined together in a renewed commitment to end the war which has cursed our nation for a decade. We welcome all of you who have come to dedicate yourselves again to the cause of peace. We're very fortunate today in having with us Congressman Donald Riegel, a Republican from the 7th Congressional District of Michigan. Congressman Riegel holds a BA from the University of Michigan, an MBA from Michigan State University, and has been on the faculty of Michigan State University, Boston University, and Harvard University. First elected to Congress in 1966, Congressman Riegel went on to become the youngest congressman ever appointed to serve on the House Appropriations Committee. In November 1967, the Washington Post carried the following statement. Despite his lack of seniority, status, and renown, Riegel is making a significant contribution to the process that must precede any intelligent reappraisal of American policy in Vietnam. Congressman Riegel.
Thank you. I am delighted to be here. I love this campus. I enjoyed studying here, teaching here, and I'm glad to be back. Before dealing with Vietnam, I'd like to just very briefly deal with Walter Adams and say that I consider him a good friend, and I consider him one of the best professors and one of the fairest men that I've ever been privileged to meet. I think he's done an outstanding job as acting president here, and I think he ought to stay in the job that he's in. You're taking my speech time. I think our most significant cost in Vietnam has clearly been the 40,000 young Americans that have been asked to give their lives. And if their voices are ever to be heard again in this country, they've got to be heard coming from our mouths. And if the work that they were ever going to do is going to get done, we've got to do it. Because they were asked to sacrifice their opportunity. And many of them in behalf of policies that they didn't really believe in. But they went ahead and did that, and they sacrificed their opportunity in a sense so that we might have our opportunity. And I say let's use our opportunity in our own name as well as theirs to end this war and to end it now. Now, I strongly support the concept of the moratorium, and I do so because I think that after all the agony and suffering, that it's altogether appropriate that as a nation and as people, that we pause to think about how it is that the war happened, where we are today, and how we can wind it up, and what the lessons are for the future. I think at the same time that it's absolutely essential that today's activities be nonviolent and non-coercive. I think we've got to make our case and conduct ourselves within the law and within reason. Now, and we can do that, and we should, not just for the reasons I cite, but because the facts are on our side. And I think we can be persuasive and be thoughtful and be responsible. And I think our job now is to take our ideas and thoughts to the rest of our fellow citizens and bring them along with us. I think most are prepared to come. Now, to me, the moratorium has to do with the First Amendment, the right to assemble, the right to free speech, and the right to petition the government for redress of grievances. I think that's what we do today, and I think it's appropriate that we do it. With that, I'd like to move directly to the question of Vietnam and talk about it from the perspective that I have on the issue. I do serve on the Appropriations Committee in the Congress, and I serve on the Foreign Operations Subcommittee, have for 3 years. This is the subcommittee that has to authorize all American international spending. And as a result, of course, this includes the money spent in Vietnam. And by virtue of this being part of my official and formal work assignment, I've had the opportunity to dig into the war. And to understand it thoroughly and carefully takes some time. It's a very complicated issue. And I found that in my own case, it took months and months of effort to piece together the picture puzzle of information that I felt I needed to understand the war fully enough to make competent and defensible judgments. With that, let me say this. This is the longest war in our history. It's an undeclared war, one that the Congress never saw fit to declare. We've lost our 40,000 men. There have been hundreds of thousands of other men wounded, amputees, and the rest of it. From a dollar point of view, we've spent in excess of $110 billion, more money than we can really conceptualize. We've dropped more bombs in Vietnam than we dropped during all of World War II, a far more concentrated area. And yet, before our subcommittee, just a few months ago, we had the top military experts appear to testify about the war. And I asked this question. I said, is there a single 10-acre area anywhere in South Vietnam that's today secure from the enemy? And after some thought, the military men that were there responded by saying, no, there isn't. There isn't a single 10-acre area anywhere in the country today that's secure and in which the enemy cannot penetrate if he so chooses. Now, that's after 8 years, and that's after bringing to bear probably the most modern and terrifying war machine that anybody's ever seen. It's a very dismal fact, but it's a very real one, and it's one that I think is well for us to keep in mind. How did this war happen? Well, it never happened with any sort of an objective decision to get in on the basis that we find ourselves today. I think it's clear if you study the record that we drifted into this war. We got in a piece at a time, a day at a time, never intending, never believing that the war would expand to the point that it has. Back in 1964, when the President, President Johnson, came to the Congress and asked for the Gulf of Tonkin resolution as a congressional response to authorize him to respond to the incident that had occurred off the coast of Vietnam, it was never the intent of the Congress, nor was it the advertisement of the administration, that he was seeking anything close to a declaration of war. And yet, years later, when members of the State Department in that administration were appearing before the Senate, they set forth the view that, in their judgment, the Gulf of Tonkin resolution, this very limited authority, was, in their mind, the functional equivalent of a declaration of war. Well, that's a lot of baloney. It isn't a functional equivalent of a declaration of war. That's an abuse of executive interpretation, and it ought to be rescinded. Now, the Constitution is very clear on the point of how this country ought to go to war, and there are procedures to be followed. And certainly, if the chief executive of the country feels that the strategic interests of the country are on the line and there's a requirement to go to war, then he's compelled to bring that case to the Congress. And the Congress is, in turn, charged with the responsibility of making the collective national judgment as to whether we're prepared to make the commitments necessary. That's never been done. Now, I don't happen to think that that case ever could have been made at the outset, that even if an effort had been made to assemble the facts, and if an accurate appraisal had been made of the costs as I've outlined them as they've occurred, at the outset, I think the Congress would probably have decided no, that our strategic interests were not enough on the line to warrant that kind of massive investment. But we never even had the chance to consider it. And I don't just blame the administration, I blame the Congress. We've been asleep at the switch in both parties. And I think we bear a good deal of the responsibility as a legislative body for the fact that this war has dragged on. We've talked about everything under the sun in the Congress. We talk about farm subsidies, and we talk about building more battleships, and we talk about everything under the sun, but we never seem to be able to bring ourselves to discuss straight on the war in Vietnam. And yet this is the most staggering problem we face. It's the number one strategic problem that we have, and it affects in a negative way everything else we try to do. And yet the Congress has been so busy with other things, we just haven't had time for our most important problem. Well, I think that's got to stop. I think the Congress has to face up to the issue, and I think one of the things that you can help do is see to it that every single member of that body has to do that now and has to come to grips with it. And I think it's way past due. If you go back and look at the circumstances that our men were asked to deal with, our military men, I think they were given an impossible task. I think they were asked to go to Vietnam under circumstances which literally foreclosed any chance for military success. The rightness or the wrongness of the issue is aside just for the moment. I think as a practical matter, we set out with an unachievable set of goals. And yet, as I say, we persisted month after month, year after year, which I think is the height of irresponsibility. We got in gradually on the idea that if we just added a few more American troops and a little more American effort, somehow the war would turn around. And by this gradual commitment, we ended up taking the war over and making it America's war. As you know, when we started out in that country, we were the advisors, they were doing the fighting. Today, they're the advisors, we're doing the fighting. Now, that's just exactly the way it's turned around. It became our war. When we woke up one day and found that we had in excess of 500,000 troops in that country and were spending in excess of $30 billion a year, we found that we had, without ever intending to, worked our way into a strategic commitment. A strategic commitment of a size that was affecting everything else that we wanted to do around the world or here at home. Well, this problem just isn't worth that kind of an investment. You can't make the case either on strategic military arguments, strategic economic arguments, strategic political, geopolitical arguments, nor can you make it on a moral set of arguments. So we just don't have the justification to involve ourselves to that degree. And recognizing that, we have no choice but to scale down and to scale down and to disengage. Now, fortunately, we've begun to do that. And you can say what you want about President Nixon. I think two significant things have happened. In May, when he made the statement that military victory was no longer a viable option for us in Vietnam, I think that was a significant statement. And it's important that it be on the record. And it's important that we call it up and point to it. And secondly, when the decision was made to begin the unilateral withdrawal of troops, this too was significant. Now, I think it can go faster, and I'm as impatient as you are. But let's not misunderstand the fact that we are on our way out. And essentially, that commitment has been made. Now, the issue, I think, is timing and the degree of urgency to get the job done. Now, I think, is where our voices can be effective in taking and speeding this thing up within the limits of reasonableness and common sense. Now, I might say this. There are still some around. Fortunately, their number is diminishing, but there are still some around who want to have one last crack at it from a military point of view, and you know who they are, who say, you know, let's drop some more bombs, if that's the answer to the war. Look, let's not kid ourselves. That's not the answer to the war. We just don't have a bomb that we can drop that is so sophisticated that when it comes down, it separates, kills the bad guys, and doesn't kill the good guys. We don't have that kind of a bomb. And this war is being conducted in South Vietnam. Over two-thirds of the enemy force, from day one right up until the present time, are South Vietnamese. Now, that's a fact. And we don't have a bomb that we can drop that is that sophisticated. So to the extent that we go ahead and drop it anyway and destroy everyone that's there, what are we really accomplishing? What are we building? If you destroy a village to save it, what have you done? Well, these are the questions that I think destroy the arguments that somehow there's a military victory out there. I don't think there is. I don't think there is. And I think it's time we face that fact. Now, there are about 17 million people in North Vietnam and some 17 million in South Vietnam. But the South Vietnamese, in my judgment, have a tremendous advantage at this point, and they have the advantage of some 8 years of intensive American effort. We've armed them. We've spent billions on nation building for school and social assistance programs of all kinds. We've spent time and resources to help train them. We've provided a military shield. We've done as much, I think, for the South Vietnamese as anyone could reasonably expect us to do. And I think beyond this point that what has to be done in South Vietnam can't be done by us or by any other outsiders, has to be done by the Vietnamese people themselves. There is no way in the world that the United States can win the commitment of the villagers of South Vietnam to a particular regime in Saigon. We can't do that job. And we shouldn't try. I think that what we have to... In a country like Vietnam, much of a jungle, where you've got villages that are out in the boondocks, not connected by roads, not connected by any form of communication, and you've got villagers living there who don't even know where Saigon is and will never get there in their lifetime, and who live right on the edge of survival, just in terms of trying to eke out a living, to assume and to presume that really matters very much to them who sits in the presidential palace in Saigon is foolish. That's not at the top of the villagers' list of priorities. It's very near the bottom. In fact, what's essentially at the top of his list of priorities is to get out of the way of the next bullet, regardless of who's firing it. And the sooner, I think, that the terror and the military activity can cease out in the villages, the better chance I think the villager has to start to fend for himself and survive. And that's a basic problem at this point. Now, to the extent the South Vietnamese regime is going to endure, the one that we're associated with today, they're going to endure based on what they do. Now, it's clear that they've not done yet the things that are necessary to win broad public support in that country. And that's just a fact, and it's documented, and the evidence is available for study. And until that regime decides to broaden itself out and to take the necessary steps in land reform and reducing governmental corruption, providing meaningful social action programs at the village level, until they do these things which have meaning in the mind of the villager and which improve the quality of life out in the countryside, they have no chance of winning public support, none at all. And we can send Americans in to set up this military shield and to fight and to die as long as we wish. But we are not, by doing that, solving this basic problem that only the South Vietnamese can do for themselves. And it's clear that they'll take just as long to do that job as we're prepared to give them. If we'll stay 10 years, it'll take 10 years. If we stay 20 years, it'll take 20 years. Well, I don't think we can stay 10 years, or I don't think we can stay 20 years. And I think now is the time to accelerate this disengagement and turn this job back to them. Let them fight this war. It's clear to me that you can't go in and build somebody else's nation. You really can't go into a different setting in the world, into a different culture and a different environment, and think for the people there. You just can't do that. I might want my children to do well in school, but there's no way in the world I can go to school and earn an education for my kids. And there's no way in the world we can go and build a nation for the South Vietnamese. If there's going to be a nation there, they're going to have to build it. And it's going to have to be the product of their dreams, what they care about, their energy, their commitment, and their blood. And that's fine with me. I'm prepared to live with the answer that they're prepared to live with. So I think what we have to do today is find a way to accelerate this disengagement. The idea that I offer for your consideration is the one that you may be aware of because it's been in the news recently, and that is that I think we have to terminate this Gulf of Tonkin resolution, and I think that's an effective way to deliver the message across the board to the enemy, to the South Vietnamese, and to our administration in Washington, that we have to set some tangible time limits on this conflict. And ambiguity is not enough. Good intentions are not enough. Partial withdrawals are not enough. We need some firm dates that we can hang our hat on so we know at a very minimum when the combat responsibility in that country will be completely phased over the South Vietnamese and the American loss of life can stop. I think we need that as a minimum goal. I don't think that's irresponsible. I don't think that undercuts the president. I don't think that's a challenge to this nation. I think that's what serves the interest of this nation. I think it helps the president. And I think it helps every citizen in America that we be prepared to take and set some definitive goals in Vietnam. So the proposal that we offer is this, that the Gulf of Tonkin resolution be amended so that it will expire effective December 31, 1970. Now that gives the president 15 months to conclude our operations there. That's a long time. We hope he won't need all that time. We hope he'll get it done faster than that. But we think we need to set as an outside limit, 15 months, the date by which that we'll be out of the business of fighting this war, and the American loss of life will stop. You may notice in the Detroit Free Press today that Senator Javits and Claiborne Pell just yesterday picked up the idea and introduced it in the Senate. We're gaining support for this. I think this is a reasonable way for the Congress to reassert its proper congressional and constitutional authority. You may have other plans, fine, if you do go out and argue for whatever plan you may have. But I think this is one alternative that makes sense. I think it's reasonable. And I think it's one that we can and should implement. Going beyond that, I would say these things in closing. One of the basic lessons of the war in Vietnam to me is the fact that we'd better face the reality that we're a very tiny minority of the world's population. We here in the United States comprise something on the order of 10% of the world's population. But the rest of the world is expanding much more rapidly than we are. So we're a shrinking percentage, a shrinking minority. I don't think that it's wise or that there's any way in the world that we can police the world on a man-for-man basis. And the sooner we destroy that notion, the better for the world and for us. I don't think we should try to impose our views on others, and I think that the hallmark of our foreign policy from today forward ought to be to try to help build a world that's safe for difference, where we can respect the fact that other people in this world are different than we are and have different ideas and different dreams for their future, and that they're entitled to their dreams just as we are, and that we ought to dedicate ourselves to developing mechanisms where we can settle our differences peacefully and go our own ways. I'm for that. I think it makes sense. But before we can expect to have much influence in this world today, much real meaningful influence and moral influence, I think we better take a look at what we're doing here at home. And we better take a look at the degree to which we live the American ideals, because we've got a long way to go, in my judgment, in doing as good a job right here as we ought to do. When we have a young black serviceman, a U.S. serviceman who comes back from Vietnam, having had his legs blown off in combat, who can't buy the house he wants to move his family into, then this country's got some changing to do. And we've got these kinds of problems. We don't have to go to Saigon or to Hanoi to find injustice. We've got injustice right here, and let's clean this injustice up. And maybe if we can demonstrate that we can really make our way of life work and work for everybody, then maybe we'll find we do have a message for the world, and maybe we'll find that people want to listen to it. So I say it's appropriate, and it's responsible for us to continue to speak out. But to speak out constructively and to speak out rationally and certainly to speak out nonviolently. I think that it's proper that we ask that a goal be set that we can depend on for disengagement in Vietnam. And I think any public official today at the federal level, regardless of party, who's unwilling to commit himself publicly on this issue has to be drawn out. I think we have to frame the issue in such a way that people have to take positions. There have been too many fence sitters for too long. We've got to get people off the fence so we know where they are. The voters need to know this because next November is coming. And this is one of the bits of input I think we all want to have. And let's have it clear and on the record as to who stands where. That's one thing we can do. And we can continue the dialogue and we can continue the discussion. And I think to the extent that we do, and we do it within the limits of the First Amendment, I think we're going to succeed because the facts are on our side. Thank you. Thank you.
Congressman Riegel does have other commitments, but we certainly appreciate his being here with us today. For those of you standing in the back, I think there are still a few seats remaining in the balcony. It's probably worth noting that this auditorium seats a lot of people, and there are very few seats remaining in the balcony. In the last play written before her death, The Sign in Sidney Brustein's Window, Lorraine Hansberry wrote these lines: "Yes, I'm a fool, always have been, a fool who believes that death is a waste and love is sweet, and that the earth turns and men change every day, and that rivers run and that people want to be better than they are, and that flowers smell good, and that I hurt terribly today, and that hurt is desperation, and desperation is energy, and energy can move things. We've come here today to move things." On June 26, 1969, a call went out from six student body presidents and newspaper editors across the country for an escalating moratorium on business as usual, beginning on October 15th. That was the seed from which has grown the most extensive movement in opposition to United States involvement in the Vietnam War since the war began. More than 500 student body presidents and student newspaper editors responded to that original call. From that base, the movement has grown to what it is today: the insistent voice of the American public for an immediate end to our catastrophic involvement in the Vietnam War. What began in June as a student movement is no longer. Congressmen, senators, university presidents, teachers, businessmen, and students have reached beyond what divided them in the past and have come together in a common cause. Today, the collective voice of the American public is being raised, and it will continue to be raised until it is heard and until our men come home. And today's only a start. If there's not a dramatic change in our government's policies beyond the delusive withdrawal of 60,000 troops, while over 450,000 remain, we will be heard again. In October, we are being heard in Lansing, in Ann Arbor, in Madison, and in other cities across the country for one day. Next month, November, we'll be heard in Washington for two. You and I have not come here to discuss United States involvement in Vietnam. Over 42,000 men have died while the war has been discussed. Over 200,000 men have been wounded and have borne scars while the war has been discussed. And while the war has been discussed, our nation too has been wounded morally and spiritually and bears scars that will never be erased. We have come here today to declare our opposition to United States involvement in Vietnam and to call for the immediate withdrawal of all American troops so that no more must be wounded and no more must die. We've come here in the name of peace. We have made another start. If we work together, if we remain firm in our commitment, we will be heard. And on the ashes of the past, we can build something stronger and something better for tomorrow. Senator Philip Hart, Democrat from Michigan, was first elected to Senate in 1958 and again in 1964. Senator Hart holds a bachelor's degree from Georgetown University, a law degree from the University of Michigan. He has served since 1969 on the President's Commission on the Causes and Prevention of Violence. During recent months, Senator was engaged in leading opposition to the deployment of the ABM system. Senator Hart,
thanks very much. Thank you very much. Thank you very, very much. Walter Adams, distinguished platform guests and Americans concerned. As that introduction indicated, I've been in this business of politics for some years and have been welcomed and rejected in many settings. No greeting was warmer than that. And though I've cranked out a lot of notes here, it's my hunch that I could best reflect my appreciation both for your greeting and for your concern by skipping virtually every one of those notes. The truth is, the purpose that brings us together, this setting, speaks eloquently just about all that need now be said. This won't spare you for a few more minutes, but I acknowledge that the physical presence, the purpose, is the message. And in highest places, whatever they may say, your influence is and shall be felt. It shall be. Let me make a confession. I am not sure any American in good conscience can get up and say he was right about Vietnam from the first day he ever heard about it. I know I wasn't. And while our motives are mixed, when one changes a position, in part at least, it reflects his response to the pressures and the petitions of others. And that's why I say that those who have not yet joined us will inevitably be affected by the kind of petition you signify today. There's one of these notes I've just got to use anyway. Just got to. It hasn't a damn thing to do with Vietnam, in a sense. In fact, there are two that haven't really a direct bearing on Vietnam. you know exactly what the note is. It's Walter Adams. I do not rise to second the nomination. I just want to testify about an aspect of Walter Adams that, unless you're in the economics class or unless you're an enormously effective reader of national publications, some of them obscure, this aspect might not have come to your attention. Let me name drop. I am the chairman of the Senate Committee on Antitrust and Monopoly. Now, who do we, when we have a real tough one, when we're really going in against the interests in capital letters, We sit down and say, now, who can get the message most clearly before the people of America? You know, every staff meeting, well, Walter Adams. And most recently, in fact, within a day or two after Don Stevens and Dr. Martin and the other regents, or the other managers here, what do they call them?
Trustees?
proved that students were not always right by themselves being right that time, by coming up with Walter's name as that acting president. He turned up in Washington before our committee, indeed it was 2 days later, to testify on the opening of the hearings on a thing that puts everybody to sleep, the oil import quota system. Major petroleum companies hope you stay asleep, incidentally. But in any event, this was the voice that spoke the hard truth. This was a fellow who, with style, cigar, and academic credentials, was able to put his finger in the eye of the utterly ridiculous argument that we have to pay, we users of petroleum have to pay in excess of $5 billion each year in order that our national security interests be protected against being shut off from cheap Middle East oil someday. There's another interesting definition of national security interest, too. Anyway, it was Walter Adams that we turned to and things like that. Now, back to the purpose. Back to the point. That is our big hang-up. How do you define national security interest? Well, we are agreed we throw away the definition of national security interest that put us and keeps us in Vietnam. That's one thing. We also throw away the definition that requires us to pay $5 billion extra for oil. This, in the tomorrows that we pray we shall all be given to see, is the thing you should stay with. After we're out of Vietnam, stay with this one. Because on the prudent definition of America's national security interest depends the avoidance of other Vietnams. And they could happen. They could happen if we don't define prudently. And this will require of you more effort, greater discipline, than rallying this magnificent crowd this morning. This one is a 365-day-a-year effort. This one begins by requiring that every American almost begin every day saying, why must the Pentagon get $80 billion a year as though by act of God? That's what we have to do. Let's not kid ourselves, and let's not alibi. Let's not blame the generals. They've never really been given a definition of what they were supposed to do by us. They get the vague impression that they're responsible for protecting us against every contingency. So they're unhappy the $80 billion isn't enough because it can't protect us against every contingency. what all of us together have to do is ensure that this discussion that we all encouraged center around the business of, all right, you've got $80 billion this year. Let's assume we cut you 10% next year and 10% the following year. Let's suppose you're down to $60 billion in a couple of years. What contingencies can you no longer protect us from? Let them spell it out. Then let us say, well, what difference does that one make? And that one would be wrong to do anyway. And the next chapter, with that $20 billion saved, where shall we apply it right here at home? That's the kind of debate. That's the kind of debate. And again, I appeal. When we're out of Vietnam, let's make sure that we remain together to talk and insist upon this kind of debate. It's the only way, I think really it's the only way we as a society have a chance for survival. If we miss the point of this one by an enormous feeling of relief and a measure of congratulation when we get out of Vietnam, we'll have blown the greatest opportunity that's ever been given us. Vietnam, for all its tragedy, all its ugliness, all its offense, has brought men and women together in this country with a common purpose, and it offers a pool that will ensure that our decisions tomorrow will be sounder. But we have to remind ourselves now, before we break up for the victory parade, the day we get out, we've got to reassemble immediately after the parade. All right, now to Vietnam. Every reason for our staying in there has been generated by the fact we got there. That's our hang up with Vietnam. It's sort of like the gambler, none of whom I'm sure are on this campus, but he's made compulsive by a growing debt. He's hopeful that the next roll of the dice will allow him to recover his losses, restore his pride, retain his dignity. I'm no PhD in anything, much less psychology or whatever that is, but I'm sure that's the hang-up. What dignity is there in supporting a South Vietnamese government that jails the fellow that ran second in their presidential race? It's to that government and its people that we should deliver the message, on and after X date, we're out of there. That's what we have to do. But when we make that declaration, whether you fix the next 4th of July, next Mother's Day, the end of next year, or whatever, before you wait for the arrival of that date, let us publicly announce an in-place ceasefire. Now, this has been suggested by many of us for a long, long time. In my book, both President Johnson and President Nixon missed magnificent opportunities, and several times, to make that announcement. And it could have reduced the killing. It would have clarified the picture. Well, let's, better late than never, announce it now. Begin the orderly withdrawal, the steady withdrawal behind that line. And having set the schedule, let's act just as we did with the fellows responsible for going to the moon. Are you on schedule? Are you on schedule? Unless you have that kind of calendar on the wall, incidents and events can intervene, which may delay the operation. Now let me say something that'll produce a chorus of boos, I know it. But I feel it, and feeling it, we'll say it. As with everything else that's said here, or any other place, I could be wrong, and all of us could be wrong. But I'd like to put in a kind word for a couple of presidents named Johnson and Nixon. Now, wait a minute. I had, when I left Johnson, and I have now, deep disagreement with specific actions and policies that they've employed. But I think we assign ourselves an infallibility that none of us ought claim, to suggest that we know that they did not really want to get out. I think no man under God could have greater reason to want to get out than whoever it is who's responsible ultimately for keeping us in. We can question wisdom, prudence, understanding. But I hope we charge just a failure of understanding and not something that's evil. In addition, I think it doesn't contribute to the debate. And think of how tough it would be to be in those fellows' shoes. How reluctant it is to fix this schedule and get out. Because let's face it, it's not easy to tell the survivors that their sons and daughters, sons and husbands have died in vain. And yet, by all the yardsticks we've ever used, that's about what it adds up. The dead of every war are silent petitioners. But the dead of this war have a stronger claim than the dead of any other war in our history. Their conflict was no popular adventure. Where they fought, there was no sense of crusade. And in their war, the national interest was very difficult to perceive. And what is their petition? What is their prayer? Well, we give them a memorial called Lasting Peace and Domestic Tranquility. That's the assignment of those of us who were never called there and those of us who survived if we went there. A lasting peace and domestic tranquility. Easy to say and tough to deliver on. But given the instruments of destruction that we have developed, if we fail to deliver that, we could indeed incinerate everything. I've skipped, at least 19 notes here. 19 notes. One said that we may have preferences about Vietnam. We might prefer one kind or another of a government. And we have some pride at stake. Pride after committing ourselves so deeply. But let's make clear to those of us who are not sitting with us this morning that preference and pride are sentiments, not interests. And the more the people of this country understand the distinction, the sooner we'll be joined in meetings like this by those who this morning think that somehow or another we're undercutting national pride by saying get out. We say we are advancing national interest by getting out. And there's a whale of a difference.